Next, we have someone very exciting. He's written a book on data for the people, which was published last year. He's went to undergrad in Germany, Cambridge in England, then a Stanford PhD studying artificial intelligence. I had to Google him this morning, and what came up? A picture of Putin and Andreas, so that's quite interesting. But without further ado, I'd love to welcome Andreas Wiegland, former chief scientist of Amazon, on the stand. When my heart is falling too, I'm in love with your body. Last night you were in my room, and now my bedsheets smell like you. Every day discovering something brand new.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's my honor to be here. Now, when I got that call about half a year ago, I was asked to speak at the Seamstress Expo in Sydney. So I was expecting 2,500 seamstresses here. And then when I asked whether they're also tailors, the phone connection was not very good, they said, yes, please tailor your presentation accordingly. And then I got here, and it turns out it's not about seamstresses and tailors, but it's about, well, about e-commerce and about payments. But for me, it really is about data. Because as Penny said, I'm a data guy. I did my PhD in physics, actually, at Stanford. I looked at the traces particle leaves as they interact with each other. Because identity, a very important question for me, really only exhibits when you interact with others. So as your customers interact with you, whether it's in the store or whether it's on the website, that's how you learn about them. So after doing my PhD, I became a professor and I was teaching at NYU, and I looked at the traces traders leave, and there's a lot of consulting for Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, helping them build so-called proprietary trading models. So predicting some part of what people will do when they trade, and then if you know a little bit more about others, then you can make trades that bet on that. And at some stage, David Shaw, who was really the first person who brought data to Wall Street. David had also Jeff Bezos as his assistant. And when Jeff was looking for a chief scientist, then he came to me and asked me whether I would actually work with him. And so I became the chief scientist at Amazon. Now that's quite a while ago, 15 years ago. Now you don't become, in Jeff Bezos' case, the richest man in the world just overnight. So it takes a lot of what I call the data DNA of the company that actually got him there. So what I want to talk to you today is not about the traces particle leaves in physics or the traces traders leave on Wall Street, but the traces people leave in the world. People leave in commerce. And then, together with you, explain and understand what came out of my years at Amazon. So the consumer-facing side, that I wrote on the book, Data for the People. And what I'm doing there is I'm explaining a few rules and rights we should have as individuals, as customers, also as citizens. We should write the rights we should have towards the organizations we interact with. For example, rights to see, transparency rights, that you should be able to access your data. These rights actually will become super important in about 100 days in the EU when the GDPR, the data protection rights, become active. So any person who is doing, any company which is doing business with Europe will have to significantly rethink how they are treating the data of European citizens. But here, the topic is not what rights you should have as consumers. that I wrote down in Data for the People. My focus of the talk is to give you the rules which came out of the same years at Amazon. What should the company do with the data that consumers share with them, whether they want it or not? And specifically, I have five rights for you, five rules that you should think about for whichever interactions you have with customers. Let me summarize those five rights, then I go through each of them, give you one specific example, and then I close with what it means for us beyond the company, for us as society. The five rights are, number one, cultivate curiosity. That means start with a question, not with the data. Two, embrace transparency. And that has both an internal perspective to it as well as a perspective to the customer. Three, make the implicit explicit. And that is probably the most central, that's why it's in the middle, of the five rules, because there I'll introduce the so-called notion of a fitness function, which tries to capture every interaction and puts a value at it from the perspective of the customer. Rule number four, respect and empower your customers. And personally, I think it's actually broader than that. Respect and empower people. And some of you will see that that rule is quite the opposite of what some marketing departments do. And the last rule loops back to me being a scientist, which is run experiments or play. Because thinking only gets that far. And if you think what really makes the world we live in the world we live in, it is that we now can do experiment at scale with hundreds of millions of people. So what took months before now only takes a minute. And when we are talking about the exponential acceleration of processes, at the heart, it is really that connectivity. All right, after this introduction, let's start with rule number one. Cultivate curiosity. As I was walking in here, you see all those stands out there in the expo. And I was wondering, what do people try to sell you? And the first stand where I stopped by was about tools for cleaning data. And then there was the next one, was about unstructured data and so on. So there are many tool vendors, and guess what? They're trying to sell you what they have. And I was surprised. There was no stand for philosophers. Nobody tried to sell you questions. They all tried to sell you answers to problems, whether you have them or not. Now, in this world of exponentially increasing data, if you start with the data, as many of the vendors outside do, it gets harder and harder. At Amazon, we call it analysis paralysis, because there's always some other data you still want to look at before you make the decision. As I tell my PhD students, you know, there's always another book in the library you could read rather than go and finish your thesis. So the same idea is here, that there's so much data out there, and if you don't have the mindset, and now comes the corollary of this first rule, what is the decision you need to make? Starting with a question, or more importantly even, starting with a decision and then going to the data that supports the decision. Let me ask you, what is the value of data? What's the value of your personal data? What's the value of some business data? Well, the decision theoretic answer is the value of data is the impact that data has on a decision. So if there is no decision that depends on some data, the value of the data is zero. So rather than cleaning something just in case, do it just in time. Start with a decision, start with a problem, start with a question and then look for the data. The data is there already, as you'll see in a few examples I'll give. In each of the cases, I want to give you one specific case. In this case, it is something that you're all familiar with, Amazon recommendations. You know, people click at X, also click at Y, which gives you early on in the consideration set an idea of hundreds of millions of customers, bundles their intelligence and presents it to you. Or people who bought X also bought Y, which helps you, you know, if a certain item is missing. Let's say you buy a hammer but forgot the nail, or you buy the nail and forget the hammer. Then it says, well, people buy hammers also buy nails. And say, ah, good idea. I think even if Amazon just came here to Australia a few months ago, you are familiar with those features. So what I want to do here is to walk you more systematically, given that problem, how can you help the customer make better decisions? How can you help the customer discover items? What the data sources are that we considered? One, we looked at experts, because at the beginning, we didn't have data. So experts were looking, well, what items might I pair with this item? But soon, some simple AI techniques, natural language processing techniques came over by, for example, for books, look at the descriptions a book had, and then look at other books where there was an overlap in words, the so-called bag of words model, and thus already a little bit of AI helping the human experts become better, become more creative. So AI not displacing the people, but helping the people. Or in other words, not a race against the machine, but a race with the machine. Step three, looked at the traces that people left, namely specifically at the searches people do. If you enter a certain item, a search, then just like Google does it, there's query refinement. I'm sure you have seen at Google when you start typing something, they complete a few options and all you have to do is pick the one. They learn that from the data, that people who start with a certain word tend to end with another way, and they reflect that back to you. That is source number three, the searches. Source number four, of course, are the clicks. And we already mentioned, people look at this item, also look at that item. Source number five, then, is the purchasing. And what I find particularly interesting is combining four and five. So I love that idea we had, which is people look at, eventually buy. Because that really is powerful, that you harvest the intelligence of hundreds of millions of people who start somewhere, who were somewhere, looked at an item, and then you show to the user what those people eventually bought. That is an example of using data to help people make better decisions. Or in other words, it's an example of where we had a question, how can we create those recommendations? And we went out and looked for the data that helped answer that question. So that was what I want to give as an example for rule number one. Start with a question, not with the data. Or cultivate curiosity. Rule number two, embrace transparency. So as I said, out of my years at Amazon came the book, Data for the People. And here are the corollaries of that, the other side of the coin. Yes, as a consumer, you should be able to demand access to the data you have. What does it mean for the company? Example again from Amazon. Amazon, and I can't tell you how the brands were opposing that. Amazon had the idea to give people, customers the opportunity to write on the Amazon website. It's called reviews. And that was 180 degrees against what marketing departments thought. They said, we need to control the message. We can't just let some consumers potentially say something bad about our product. Do you see this radical shift in embracing transparency here? In this case, transparency to the customer. That rather than just regurgitating what the brand says, saying, look, we are a platform. We let people say whatever they want to say. And do you see how that helps people make better decisions? Just reflect on how you pick an item or a hotel room or a flight. In many cases, not what the company website says, but it's the data that people like you have contributed. That's a radical shift in transparency. And ultimately, and I personally love this, the brands had no choice there, because the data was out. And all they could do is learn from the data. And if there is certain criticism which appears again and again, maybe actually fix it. That was the example 2A of embracing transparency and giving the customer visibility into the company. It is not only the case for customers, but also for suppliers. Walmart, for instance, has a tool called Retail Link. And what does this do? It allows the supplier visibility onto the shelf, which helps the supplier figure out what to do, rather than the old style, oh, we are not showing them anything, we are suppressing, we are pushing the prices down between suppliers. So it's again this sign flip, this mindset shift of embracing transparency and getting an overall better decision process by doing so. 2B, embracing transparency internally within the organization. My friend JP Rangaswamy, who works at Deutsche Bank, he, a few years ago, did an experiment. He said, anybody who has access internally to the network at Deutsche Bank can read all of his emails, both incoming and outgoing. Again, that is radical. I certainly would not be comfortable if, you know, anybody who I work with would see all of my emails. I don't know about you. So he did the experiment, and he said, after a few weeks, all the bickering, which was 90% of the inbox, you know, I couldn't do this because he didn't give me this, and so on and so forth, all that bickering stopped. And the people who he was considering having a conversation with, or whether there might be another future somewhere else for them, they resigned. So I know that many of you are not comfortable with this, but I'm just giving you an example of what embracing transparency actually really could mean. Here's another example. Whole Foods, a company that was acquired by Amazon last year, has as a policy that everybody at Whole Foods can see the salaries of everybody else. So if I think back, my days when I was teaching at NYU, where my consulting agreements didn't even allow to tell anybody that they existed. And now anybody can look up how much I make. I teach at the University of California at Berkeley, and yes, anybody can look up the salary anybody makes at the university. So those are really fundamental shifts of how we think about data, and in this case, those are examples for here embracing transparency, which was rule number two. Rule number three, make the implicit explicit. Here are also two meanings. The first meaning is, and you know that maybe as pattern recognition or machine learning, that you find ways where you see what actually is happening in the big data set. It used to be knowledge discovery, data mining. There are many ways to describe this, that with all these people leaving traces, you can now figure out what actions to take. For example, there's a number of payment companies out there. So how do you determine whether a certain transaction is fraud or not? You look at the patterns. What I want to make here is I want to show you the second meaning of making the implicit explicit. And that concrete example for this is Amazon's fitness function. Jeff and I spent probably 50 hours, maybe even more, together figuring out how to weight all the possible interactions it could come up with between the customer and the company. So for example, if a package arrives a day late, happens, what would the cost be? And I don't mean the cost that Amazon has to pay to FedEx or something. No, the cost in the relationship with the customer. Well, is it a dollar? Is it $10? Is it 1%, 10% of the item? So we didn't know the answer, but we made some of these implicit things explicit. We wrote down something. And then over time, of course, we adjusted it. But that overall function, that fitness function, which described the overall health of the company, had hundreds of terms. That, I think, was the heart of Amazon, to quantify whatever could be quantified. Now, I'm a physicist, and of course, I'm aware of this wonderful saying of Albert Einstein, which is, not everything that can be counted counts. And not everything that counts can be counted. But just like analysis paralysis, that you might not have all the data that should not stop you from doing some action, from taking some decision. Same thing here. You might not have the perfect fitness function, but over time, you learn, in the case of, say, employees, where you have certain rules which they then follow, and you say, oh, well, that's not what I intended, and then you have to add maybe another term. It's a very different culture from many, many other places. Penny mentioned my meeting with Putin last year. When my book launched in Germany, I got a call from the German military whether I would be willing to come for lunch to the Department of Defense. I said, sure, I'm here anyways. And then they asked me, they heard my talk, whether I could do a workshop for the generals. I said, sure, why not? And they said, you know, it would be good to do it in uniform. And I actually honestly, I said, sure, I'll come in here early and I'll see what fits me. That was not their idea of doing it in uniform. So I did that workshop for the generals, and I was actually very, very hesitant of telling some of the stories which I normally do in workshops. And the guy I sort of had as the person to help me with, I was surprised just how open they were. Here's one story I told them, which I was ready to get thrown out of the room, like, they confiscated my uniform and threw me out or something, which was, how did Amazon internally, you know, deal with rules? At every all hands, and mind you, that was a time when we were about 1,000 people in Seattle. Amazon now has more than 500,000 people, so some things don't scale to 500,000. But when it was 1,000 people, at all hands, two people were picked to come to stage. The first person got a handshake and a pair of worn Nike shoes. That was a Just Do It award. That was given for a person who violated the rules of the company, but did the right thing in the spirit of the company. And then the second person, they saw it coming, also got a handshake with the very best wishes of Jeff, whatever his future might be. That was a person who followed the rules exactly, but didn't do things in the spirit of the company. So for example, I remember one, and then we were explained what it was, one person who was in the call center, and a customer called in and said, you know, I ordered that set of pots, and it turns out that you have a 20% off today on those pots, and they haven't arrived yet. Can I get those 20% discount? And the agent said, no, sir, we can't do that. But you can send the pots you're getting back, and then you can order the new ones, and then effectively, you also have it. It's a little more work, but you get your 20% discount. That was following the rules, but not the spirit of customer centricity. So the reason I took the time to tell you here about this fitness function and about the rules and how they get modified is I just want you to understand that people make mistakes, but that notion of having a function which is global is, in my opinion, the right way to think and to also be able to evaluate experiments. I had a very hard day about a month ago because I decided to give up the secondary residence I had, which was in Shanghai, China. I had that for 17 years. And you know, in 17 years, you accumulate a lot of stuff. And compressing it down to 2 suitcases, which I was allowed to take with me on the aircraft, was not easy. And I was reflecting back onto the 17 years. Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba, had me at his data coach in the early days of Alibaba. Maggie, actually, who is going to speak tomorrow evening at the end, she was his assistant at the time. So I'm actually very much looking forward to her talk tomorrow evening, which is reflecting on her 17 years with Jack Ma, and she's currently the country manager for Australia and New Zealand. And one of the reasons why I left is that the Chinese government is really amazing in their usage of data. For example, everybody has a so-called Sesame score. So I use, because otherwise there's no way of getting around China, Alipay on my mobile. And Alipay is one of the very few things which I really think is an amazing Chinese invention. We do not have that in the US, and that's amazing how in a couple of years, 1 billion people adopted the technology. And so if you have Alipay on the first screen, on the right second row, is that little button and you can push it, and it tells you your Sesame score. So as I said, data is only worth as much as the decisions that these data influence. Ladies and gentlemen, it is absolutely scary how many decisions in China are based on that score. If your score is not high enough, you cannot get a ticket for the high-speed railway. If your score is not high enough, your child cannot go to a good school. If the score is not high enough, of course, you can't borrow money. So it's not a score which is a play score. It's a score that determines a lot about an individual and their children. So how does the score get calculated? As I said, Ant Financial does it. So let's say you're jaywalking, minus 1 point. Fare evasion on the train, minus 10 points. Shoplifting, minus 50 points. Selling counterfeit goods on Taobao, plus 200 points. Because obviously, this person knows how to actually work in this economy. So there you see this problem. If you have one company that is both responsible for creating that score and interested in you doing certain things. Why did I use that example? I use that example because I believe our conversation needs to be on the level of that fitness function. So obviously, I disagree with some of the weights they put in. But I think it's the right conversation to have. What do we want, not only as company, but also as society, to sit? What weights do we want to have on those terms? 4. Respect and empower the customer. That rule sounds almost trivial. Respect and empower people is something I deeply believe in. I just want to put in your mind, look at marketing. Look at how you interact within your company, with your customers, with others. And every now and then, reflect whether really your action is meant to empower the customer or whether some smart person thought, you know, if we just screw the customer here, we'll be doing well for our shareholders. And the last rule is the rule which I think loops nicely back to the beginning. Run experiments. Or in other ways, you came up with these questions. You wanted to know hypotheses. How do people behave? What happens as I change things? And now we are able to run those experiments. And that is a different mindset. That's the mindset that we come up with hypotheses. And I was pretty impressed by Piyush Gupta, the CEO of DBS Bank in Singapore, when he hired me for a workshop to help his bank innovate. And we discussed what the deliverables are. He said, Andreas, I want 5 hypotheses. I don't want answers from you. You know, I can get answers from other people. But I want to get 5 questions at the end of the day. I gave him 8 just to be on the safe side. So to summarize, in this talk, I start a bit from the biographic perspective of how I've always been able and been fortunate to not only speak data, but to basically breathe data. At CERN, where it was in the 80s when the web got created, then in Silicon Valley, for the last 30 years. I was very fortunate to do my PhD thesis on AI, which is crazy. 30 years ago, to do a thesis on neural networks. It was the first thesis where somebody did neural networks towards prediction. And this is not because I'm smart. I just got lucky to be at the right place at the right time. And then same thing for Amazon. I just got lucky to work with an amazing human being at the right time. And then what I did is, out of those experiences, I tried to condense it into 5 rules, which I think are good rules for companies to follow. Those were the rules that we had at Amazon. To summarize, 1, start with the data. You know, start with the problem, not with the data, or cultivate curiosity. 2, embrace transparency. 3, make the implicit explicit. It was a thing with a fitness function. 4, respect and empower your customer. And 5, run experiments. Ultimately, it's not only about the data set that you have. It's not only about the tool set that you can buy. It's not only about the skill set, data scientists, that you can also buy. It's not cheap. But ultimately, it's about the mindset. Thank you very much.